Hi everyone, welcome to How Can I Heal podcast with Krina Okumus. This is an interview series with people that I admire and really made a change in my life. We are exploring questions about life, dreams, how can I be more happy and healthy, and learn how can we deal with pressure or challenges in the private or professional life. I really hope you take a nugget of wisdom or two and you are improving your own life for the better. I'm super happy and honored to let you know that on today's podcast, I'm speaking with Christine Carlson. We worked together a year ago when I started a non-profit Omnes.live together with some friends. She joined as a meditation teacher. Her Golden Light meditation, it's truly one of my favorite. Christine Carlson is the New York Times best-selling author, speaker and leader in the field of transformation. After collaborating with her late husband, Dr. Richard Carlson, to create a publishing industry phenomenon with Don't Sweat the Small Stuff series, selling more than 25 million copies worldwide, today, Chris is emerging as a profound teacher in the areas that matter most to the human heart: how to heal and how to love. I feel very touched by her story and the power she had to stand up and continue her life without the most important person on her side. A lot of us have had that moment in life when we are ready to embark upon a new beginning. But how do we make it a reality for ourselves? That's the question.
When you're going through immediate loss, when you're just going through it, I would tell you to not busy yourself. I would say to allow yourself lots of spaciousness to be in a cocoon of healing, to create, time with, definitely spend time with your family and close friends. Don't isolate away from other people. But definitely don't be overly busy. Don't try not to go back to work too fast. Try not to, be so busy that you're distracted from grieving. Because if you really have grief, you want to allow yourself time to heal and time to grieve.
And now let's get to my conversation with the amazing Christine Carlson. Hello, Christine. Thank you so much for taking time for me today.
Hi, Krina. So wonderful to be with you here today. Thank you for having me.
I was thinking that we actually really start to work together, I can say. Actually, you support me exactly a year ago or plus minus a few days ago. And I want to thank you again so much for supporting the Omnes, the nonprofit activity that you really join the amazing meditation. And already I remember we received so many amazing feedbacks after your Golden Light meditation.
Oh, thank you. It was such a joy. And I was just so honored and also so thrilled to see you step forward like that and to create that at the beginning of the, really the tumultuous year that we had with the COVID and the pandemic all around the globe. So it was really beautiful to be connected. And I want to applaud you for having, the fortitude and the courage and the wisdom to create that for everyone.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Coming from you, as I said even before, really means a lot. And you are really a true inspiration, I'm sure, for so many. But already with the story that you are sharing, healing so many people, but as well helping me to go into this healing journey. And I want to thank you so much for that. I'm very curious. Can we start with the beginning? Like, when you were young, what did you want to be? How did you dream about you?
Oh my goodness. That's such a funny question, because when I think back to when I was young, I could have never dreamed up my life as wonderful as it's been. I would have never, ever dreamed that I would be an author, or I would have been married to a famous author. I, however, did dream of meeting Richard. So interestingly, I think I always knew the man that I was going to marry, and I knew exactly what he would be like because I had a wonderful relationship with my father. And my father has been just the quintessential father for a little girl. He was so nurturing and so guiding and so wise and such high integrity. And he's still alive, by the way.
I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, but I do feel that because of my close relationship with my father, I really knew when I met Richard that he was the one. I knew immediately. I mean immediately, like within a couple of hours after meeting him. So
yeah, I wanted to ask, jumping now to the next part. Sorry. How did you really meet Richard? Dr. Richard Carlson.
Yeah, so we met, I was a freshman and he was a transfer tennis star from San Jose State to Pepperdine University. He was transferring as a sophomore and was 2 years older than I was at the time. And I came from Oregon, he was from Northern California. And we both landed at Pepperdine University. We met just, you know, I think he actually, well, I know, he saw me on campus. And he was a very shy man when he was younger, extremely shy, but he was a great athlete, like a really top tennis player. He was number one in California and ranked 5 in the nation and had played in Wimbledon that summer before I met him. So he was super, super accomplished tennis player, but he was what we call redshirted when I met him. So he wasn't actually playing with the team. And, you know, he saw me on campus and he told his friend, "I want to meet that girl. That's the one I want to meet at the school."
No.
And, yeah, yeah. Oh,
so beautiful.
So when he was, one day I was walking back from brunch, like on a Sunday, and I was alone because everybody kind of vacated the campus that weekend, but I decided to stay on campus. And I could see this really cute guy with this other guy just sort of lagging and looking back and laughing and kicking up their heels. And I thought to myself, oh, that guy, I knew the one. I knew the one guy, and then I didn't know the other. And I said, oh, the other guy wants to meet me. So I just sped up and said, hey, wait for me. And then I, you know, made it super easy. I said, hi, you know, I'm Chris. And then we got introduced and we were walking back and it turned out our dorms were side by side. And so we stood there, all three of us, talking for some time. And I could tell Richard kind of motioned to his friend to leave. And then Richard and I stood in front of this tree. Our dorms happened to be side by side. And I had this just odd feeling come over me. And I realized in that moment when I was talking to him, you know, I was only 18 years old. I was a baby. But I was a pretty wise young woman for a lot of reasons. And he was a fairly wise young man for a lot of reasons. And so I just had this strange feeling inside, like I recognized that I had never felt so comfortable with another human being, where I had just met him and I could be myself. I could be completely myself. And I noticed that, like, I was like, I have never felt so much myself with a guy, especially a new guy that I'm, you know, super hot and really attractive. And I was like, I can't believe I feel this way. But then I went upstairs and I always called my mom on a Sunday, and I went upstairs and my mom, you know, and I were talking, and she said, well, have you met anybody at school? And I'm like, yeah, it's really strange. I think I just met the man I'm going to marry. Wow. And it just popped out of my mouth, and she started laughing. She goes, well, have you gone out with him yet? I go, no, I haven't gone out with him yet.
I love that.
Yeah, so first things first, right?
First things first, yeah. And he was a tennis player. That's so interesting. So basically, what was happened after that? Because was the moment when he decided to, I mean, I know that you were influencing him here.
Oh, I did. I did. It's very interesting because I remember this morning very vividly because I had given him advice in that first conversation about how to move off campus. And So he did what I told him to do and he got off campus, but I didn't see him for 2 weeks. And this one morning I was headed down very, very early. I would go for a run and I went into the cafeteria very, very early because I was super nervous. I had this big modeling interview with this modeling agency in LA and I was super, super nervous. And I saw Richard sitting down there and I hadn't seen him in 2 weeks, but I was so nervous. I even remember what I was wearing that day and what he was wearing. Isn't that strange? I didn't know exactly what I was wearing. I was like wearing white sweats and a red plaid flannel shirt. My hair was pulled back in a ponytail, French braid, and I had no makeup on. And he was wearing his Pepperdine sweats and a white t-shirt, which is what he always wore. And I saw him and I thought, I was so nervous, but then I thought, oh God, I don't want to see anybody. I'm too nervous. But then I saw him and I thought, oh, I don't want him to think I don't like him. So I better go say hi. So again, I went and I sat down and I said hello. And as soon as I was in his presence, I felt this calm come over me. And I just felt this feeling of being home and just being really held. And just, I felt so comforted by just being with him. And then we talked. And in that conversation, I can tell you the moment that Richard fell in love with me, because in that conversation, I said to him, I said, how come you're always wearing sweats? And he said, oh, I hit with the tennis team. And I was like, I thought I knew all the tennis players because I thought they're the hottest guys on campus. Like, I thought I knew all the tennis players, but I didn't know he was on the tennis team. And so I go, but when he said he hit with the team, I just thought, oh, he's just a wannabe tennis star, like a wannabe. And so I go, oh, do you love tennis? And because you must play a lot of it. And he goes, he kind of looked at me really odd. And he goes, well, no, I really don't love tennis. It kind of feels like work to me. And I go, well, if you don't love it, why do you spend so much time doing it? That doesn't make any sense at all.
Of course, yeah.
And he goes, well, yeah. He goes, and then he just kind of was silent. And I go, if you don't love it, why don't you just quit? And he got this look on his face, like it seriously, he looked at me like, I love this girl. and he said, nobody's ever told me that before. And of course, I didn't know that he was the number one slated like tennis player on our team. He was just redshirted and he was number one in the number one team in the nation. And I told him to quit tennis. And he said, you know, I'm going to think about what you've said. And later that day, I went back to my dorm and I was talking to my suite mate. And I was really excited that I had met him. And I was excited for my interview that afternoon. And then I said, I just met the coolest guy. I've met him a couple weeks ago, but I really just sat down and talked to him today. And she goes, oh, what's his name? And I said, his name is Richard Carlson. And she goes, you just met Richard Carlson? And I was like, yeah, I go, why? And she said, and she pulls out the Pepperdine Voice newspaper and there's this picture of Richard and he's like 3.5 feet off the ground and he's leaning back with his racket and he has this grimace on his face. And I mean, he's the real deal tennis player. And I looked at that and I went, and it said number one seated player at Pepperdine redshirted for the season. And I just literally went, oh my God.
What I need.
Yeah, told him to quit tennis. And she goes, are you kidding me? If you just told Richard Carlson to quit tennis, you would be the most unpopular girl at Pepperdine. I go, well, maybe not with Richard.
I love that.
Yeah, so that I think that was the real beginning of our love. And the fact that I did support him that year in giving up his dream to become a professional tennis player, because he knew deep down in his heart that he was called to something even bigger. And he was really called, you know, he didn't know for many, many years that he would write books, but he knew he was called to serve humanity on some level. I mean, I think he really knew at a very young age that he was called to higher purpose.
And what about you, Kristen? How did you feel during that time? What you mentioned that you wanted to go to a modeling agency, and this is how actually we start our discussion. What was your dream?
Yeah, you know, I mean, at the time, I was I always felt like life was three steps ahead of me. I always felt very led through my life. I mean, when I got that interview with Wilhelmina Modeling Agency, I didn't even try to get it. Somebody else, another photographer, had sent a photo, like a Zed card, to them on my behalf. And then they called me. So there's this way that I've always just allowed the divine to lead me. And I've just been open. I'm like a big yes. I think that I've allowed the divine to be in charge, you know, and I do have dreams, but I'm very flexible within those dreams because my whole life has shown me that planning and over planning can sometimes be to my detriment. It can be a limitation versus an unlimited possibility when you really open your heart and your whole mind to allowing, you know, divine love and divine guidance to be the lead. I kind of inadvertently learned that, but I have practiced it forever and I practice it now even. So I, of course, in my business life, in my entrepreneur life, I have to have plans, but those plans are very, very flexible and very open and very, very much open to allowing for opportunities and for things that maybe I couldn't think of or plan to come in.
But when everything started related to the spiritual growth, I know that you both start this together. And when yeah. was that moment? When was happening and how?
You know, it's very interesting because Richard's parents, I came from a very evangelical Christian home in Oregon, very conservative parents and family, and wonderful family, but very conservative. And Richard's family was very liberal, extremely liberal, California, Northern California, liberal family. And his dad at the time had this huge company and he would bring Ram Dass into his company to teach. And this is back in the 80s, you know, and he brings Stephen Levine and Ram Dass and all of these, you know, kind of crazy people at the time that people would, my parents wouldn't even know who they were, you know, but Richard had this great exposure to Wayne Dyer and Ram Dass and all these great leaders. And because of that, his parents introduced us to a transpersonal psychologist and they were seeing her for their marriage. And then his dad just wanted his whole family to see her and learn how to meditate through her. And so we learned how to meditate through her when we were really young. You know, I was still just about 20 years old. And then his dad was so generous and he told us that he would pay for any therapy that we wanted to do and any kind of therapy. And so so we were in LA, so of course we had every therapy.
Of course, the paradise.
we had therapy of the gazoo available to us. So we did everything from rebirthing to Reiki and breath work to just so much breath work. And we would see psychic mediums and psychics and you know, anything. I mean, anything and everything. And we'd do like flotation tanks and I mean, it was crazy. We did a lot of, and so it was beautiful because we were also really tuned into seeking and mm-hmm. we were meditating at a very young age and we found a guru together. Sai Baba was our guru and we just started this journey together and we were into crystals. I would bring crystals to my tests and I would hold them. To be centered and grounded and people would look at me and then they'd ask me what that was and I would tell them. So, you know, it was always like that for us. We were really fortunate that we got on this path of seeking and just sort of really and loving to learn and, you know, all the great religions. Richard was a really super avid reader, much more avid reader than I, but just an avid, I think he read about 5 books a week. So he was a super wow. avid reader and seeker. And yeah, it was an incredible journey. I mean, especially the meditation part and finding Sai Baba together.
And I think 2 years after you met, you already got married, right?
It was 4 years.
Oh,
yeah.
4 years. Very, 4 years. Anyway, very, yeah. very soon. I mean, very young.
Yeah, we were very young. It was right after I graduated from Pepperdine, and then he had graduated 2 years prior. And Richard went right into a bodywork therapy. He became a certified Rolfer, Ida Rolf, from the Rolf Institute. And then
can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. So he started out his career in a bodywork therapy called Rolfing, R-O-L-F-I-N-G. And that was from Ida Rolf. And it was an integration, like a working with the fascia connective tissue, an integration healing kind of therapy for people. And he did that while he got his master's and PhD in psychology. And so he really had this great understanding of the body and of the emotional body, and then of this, you know, of the spiritual body. And then he really wanted to understand the mind and how the mind impacted the body and how the mind impacted life, you know. And that's why he studied this very unusual form of psychology, which was called psychology of mind. And that was kind of the basis of his formal training. And then what he decided to write about was really based on these five principles that he had mastered and learned and really understood at a very deep level. And we were, you know, talking about this stuff way before, you know, I mean, now it's just part of what we talk about. But if you can imagine 30 years ago, when people weren't talking about thought, for example, or, you know, present moment living, or, you know, all these principles that are just kind of mainstream principles today. But it was like speaking a foreign language to people then, but they would get it. And so, you know, that's really at the basis of his teaching are these five principles about thoughts, moods, feelings, separate realities, and present moment living. And we both learned them together, which was why when he asked me and invited me into writing with him later in our lives in the Don't Sweat the Small Stuff book series, I was able to do that because we were living proof that these five principles, when practiced, would create a really miraculous, happy life.
And this is so beautiful. And like you said, I mean, I would love to have this experience when I was 20. I mean, it's amazing to really explore this and to understand this.
It really was. It was amazing. And we were very, very fortunate that we were both so enthusiastic.
I can imagine. I think even starting writing together was another beautiful moment. Another kind of, even for the couple, I would say, very interesting
journey.
Exactly. I think it's so beautifully how everything went together. Yeah. And you have two beautiful daughters. How old are they now?
We do. Jazz is 31 and Kenna is 29. And Jazz has five kids and they're all hers, you know, with her husband. And then Kenna.
You are Nana, right?
Yeah.
I'm calling you Nana.
Yep. I'm a Nana. Five times.
Somehow you are too young to be a grandma. Aww. Like, really, you look amazing. And
I probably am too young to be a grandmother.
That's why it's good, Nana. It's good. It's very good.
Exactly.
I think it's perfect.
Okay. When she got pregnant with her first baby, I was just like, oh my gosh, I still have one at home. How can you do this? You know? But that was her path, and you know, it's been her path, and she's a wonderful mother. So, you know, she's done. I mean, she was done before the last one, but the last one I think is her favorite. So,
Going back to the writing, I know that Richard already wrote 10 books before the very well successful Don't Sweat and Small Stuff, The Small Stuff.
You did your research. Good job.
No, but I really wanted to really understand all these parts because, yeah, I'm really fascinated by you and Richard's life. And as I said before, you are really a big inspiration.
Oh, thank you.
What do you think it was the change for him? What was changing that suddenly the 11th book had such a huge success?
You know, really was looking for a way to innovate his own writing. And he started to notice that people were really busy, especially with the beginning of the technology era, you know, with being online and cell phones. And he just really started to notice that technology was speeding things up for people. And so he decided that he wanted to write a book that was really easy for somebody to read and very quick reading. So he found that small format, and he found that essay format really worked well for him, and he loved it so much. Like he loved writing that way. And so when he switched over from writing long chapters to an 800 word essay, that changed everything. And that book, and because of the title too, that book they could not keep that book in stock. And I think it's because the timing of it was impeccable to where people were at that time, where they were overwhelmed by technology. And we all thought that, oh, being online and the internet and having email would save us time. And it didn't save us time. It got us busier.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. It took more of our life away. And so did cell phones. You know, like you all suddenly didn't have freedom when you got in your car and you left house. You know, like everybody could still reach you. So, you know, I think that we don't realize what the world went through in that age when all of that was coming into play and growing. But that, I think, was one of the reasons why Don't Sweat the Small Stuff did incredibly well and incredibly quickly, is because people were sweating the small stuff. And it was kind of that kind of idea. But really, he just was looking for a format that would work for people. And he just felt like that short format would really be the way to go. And he was right.
I love that book. And obviously, I'm sure many of us knows it. If you allow me, I would love to read a short sentence that I really love, written by Richard. Absolutely. When are you going to die? In 50 years? 10? Today? Often wonder when listen to the news, did the person who died in auto accident remember to tell his family how much he loved them? Did he lived well? Did he loved well? When people look back on their lives, on their deathbed, they wish the priority to be quite different. They wish they spent time with the people and activities that they truly loved. So beautiful.
Yeah, that was so beautiful. And I have to tell you that Richard did that. You know, the day before he died, he left me a note in my car, and he left notes all over the house for my kids. And he even sent his sister a card in the mail that she got the day after he died. And he told her he loved her. And he told us all in so many ways all the time whenever he left that he loved us. And I'll never, ever forget that, because he really lived, and, you know, he lived his life the way he taught others to live their lives.
I have to say, I'm trying to really not feel that I'm in tears now, but I could really imagine on the other side your life when you probably got the call. I know that he died in the plane, right?
Yeah. He was promoting his latest book, and so he wasn't feeling great, but he was kind of like that guy that, you know, he just powered through not feeling well. And I remember saying to him a couple days before, he was unusually tired, and I remember asking him if maybe he should go to the doctor, you know, and he said, no, I'm fine, you know, I'm just a little tired. And then, yeah, he got on that flight, and apparently, I mean, he was in a pretty good mood that morning, because he left a voicemail to his assistant to buy me like an iPod for Christmas. It was right before Christmas, and he made the comment on that voicemail that he was feeling so good. He was all caught up, which was really crazy, because, you know, one of his famous quotes is, when you die, your in-basket won't be empty. Mm-hmm. And that happened to be on his website that day. that when you die, your in desk, it won't be empty. And I got on that flight, and on the descent of that flight, Richard had a blood clot that released from his leg and exploded in his lung. It's a pulmonary embolism and it kills you instantly. So I don't believe that he had much recognition of what was happening. I think it probably was super fast. And yeah, I got a phone call, like, you know, when the plane landed and they got him to the hospital, a doctor called, and, you know, I was driving and I was just pulling into a mall parking space, and they asked me if I was parked, and I started to really panic. Why, you know? And I said, you know, they said, we have your husband here. And I said, well, what do you mean you have him there? Is he all right? And they just said, no, I'm sorry, Mrs. Carlson, Mr. Carlson has expired. Mm. And I just, you know, that word, I mean, in some ways it was the perfect word for Richard because he was such an inspired person. But at that time, that word was, it was just out of the blue for me. Mm. I had no idea that he could even have died. Like, I was like, what? You know, I mean, it was just a crazy, crazy next 15, 20 minutes that I literally left my body. I mean, when the reality of what had happened really hit me and it was over and I knew that he was gone, I didn't want to be here. You know, I wanted to leave. I wanted to be with him. And then I heard his voice, and he said, you have to remember our daughters. And I remember hearing that, and I remember a conversation that he and I had, and it was that the worst loss that you could ever live through would be to lose one of your children, and the second worst loss that you could ever live through would be to lose a partner that you really loved and that you lived life with. And I knew, you know, I heard him say, you've got to stay. You can't come with me. You can't come with me. And I went in, I got back in my car and I pulled on my steering wheel like I was giving birth. I just pulled on that steering wheel so hard to bring myself back into my body. And I had to face, you know, had to face life from that moment on. And it was a different life. And I'm not unusual when I say this. A lot of widows say this, that they died a death with their husband that passed, because you definitely feel that you've died, and you've died with them, because such a huge part of your life is suddenly over, and it leaves you feeling half of a person for a long time. You feel like you're walking around half of a person. You're not a whole person for a really long time.
And you were so young. You were 43 and he was 45. The girls, yeah, they were 15, 17. I was even thinking during that time, quite a difficult age for a young, yeah, girl.
Very, very difficult. It was really hard on my kids, and especially Kenna, my youngest, especially her. It's a very, very tough age for a girl to lose her father at that age. They're just coming into themselves and their identity, and they really need their father at that age. And he was such a great, I mean, just such a wonderful father. Like, he, you know, Kenna was always the more emotional one in our household, and Richard would just be able to lie with her in her emotions and just hold her and let her have her emotions. And I was more like the tough one, like, oh, you're going to go cry in your room, you know?
I can't imagine that. I cannot imagine you doing this, Christine.
Oh yeah, no, I definitely have I have a tough side. My girls would tell you that. Like, I have that German matriarch inside. It's like, says a little bit, the suffer in silence. but no, he was such a empathic and just compassionate, you know, wonderful human. And he was really able to hold her in all her emotions. And I know that she went for a long time and really, really missed that, and really missed that person that was such a grounding force for her. So she's wonderful today. And both my girls are doing really well. And They're wonderful women. They're such good women.
I mean, with such amazing parents, I cannot imagine different kids, honestly.
Yeah, how, both really great, great people.
How did you integrate what you learned during all these years that you learned together with Richard? How did you integrate this for your girls and for yourself?
Well, you know, I mean, for my girls, you know, what was challenging about being, you know, kind of a powerful couple and a powerful self-help couple. And what's challenging is that, you know, you kind of need to let your kids grow into that. Like, you can't force it down their throat, or, you know, they don't really, I mean, I'm sure my kids thought we were a little weird, to be honest with you. Like, we certainly didn't live life like other parents did. But I think they just get it, because I think what you really want when you raise a family is you want them to be kind people, and you want them to have a strong value system. And that's really what we taught our kids, was to really have a very strong value system, and to value other people, and to treat other people the way you wish to be treated, and to be kind at all costs. And even when sometimes people think you're weak because you're kind, you know, we would always say, you know, you always have to be the kindest person in the room if you can be. And both of my daughters are just incredibly grateful and incredibly kind people. And they're very loyal, and they really treat people well. And I'm most proud of each of them for that they would not hurt anyone intentionally ever. And they have been hurt a lot, but they would never hurt anyone intentionally. They're both incredibly kind. You know, for me, I mean, I think that because of our lives as meditators, and because of all that we had been exposed to before we had kids, and I think that all of that really just helped me so much in my own healing. Because the truth is, you know, you go through trauma, and even if you're a super strong and courageous and, you know, got your kind of your life together before that happens, there's a time for everyone, even the strongest person, when they crumble. And I crumbled too. And my life had shattered before my very eyes. And while it on the outside looked very stable, because, you know, I didn't have financial worry, which I felt very grateful for. And I had lost my best friend, my life partner, a man that I cherished, a man that I loved equally and even more that day than I had 20 years, 25 years earlier. You know, it was an incredible loss. And yet I also knew deep down in my heart that this was not an accident for my growth and for my life and for what I was here to discover. And so I immediately knew that this was somehow part of my soul growth and part of my contract with Richard. And I wished it wasn't true. And I resisted it to some degree in the beginning, but I knew I had to face it, and I had to stand in it. And I had a lot of faith that if I allowed my body to teach me how to grieve, that if I grieved and I emptied out all of the sadness that I would feel, that eventually I would return to joy. And that was my hope. Of course, I didn't know that starting out, but I did learn very quickly how to surrender to grief and how to surrender to healing. And really, I surrendered to my body teaching me and letting my body tell me when I wasn't crying enough, or when I needed to lay on the floor and just shake so that I could cry. And, you know, it was a process. It's a process of healing. And it wasn't quick for me. As much as I know about spirituality, and I knew then, and as much faith as I had, it still wasn't a quick process for me. It took me, you know, a couple of years of very, very deep, deep grieving. And then 10 years, I mean, I'd say, you know, I really feel like I just came out of it a few years ago, where I'm like, I can really, really feel this strength that has come back to me, and this joy, this unspeakable, just unfathomable joy. And I'm so grateful that you can go through, you know, what is really unthinkable loss, where you can't even imagine it, and then come out the other side and feel so incredibly happy to be alive.
And I love what you said about keeping allowing your grieving to heal you.
Yeah, I think most people, they think of grief like they want to get out of it as fast as possible. And they I mean, I've heard even people in the movement of, you know, healing from grief, you know, I hate grief. I hate it. It's like an enemy. And I always said, no. Grief is your friend. Grief has come to heal you. Grief doesn't last forever. It's comes and it goes. And you want to allow grief, because if you resist grief, it will stay and it will find, you know, it'll find a place to burrow and hide, and it'll create havoc in your life. And I think that if you start to befriend grief, I mean, it's a little bit like people who have to learn to live with cancer, you know, while they're healing, while they're fighting cancer, they're living with cancer. And grieving is not that different than that. It's something that comes into your life because of this love, this deep, tremendous love and attachment that you have for another. And when that other dies, when the other passes on, you are left behind and you have to reconcile that loss. You've got to reconcile life without that person in the same capacity. One thing I would love to share with your listeners that really helped me was to understand and to find Richard, and to understand that he really was around me, and to feel that, and to feel that connection to him through our love. And I did immediately. I immediately knew that he was right there, and I immediately could feel him. And that saved me. I mean, that really, that recognition that he wasn't gone saved me. Because I don't think I could have lived if I thought he was gone. If he was truly gone, I would be like, I can't do this. But because I felt him, and people say, well, how do you know you felt him? And it's like, well, you know that all those times that you're with your partner and they're like in the same room, but you're not even facing them, and you're being both totally quiet, mm-hmm. but you feel them. You feel that they're there. It's like that. It's like you feel them. They're there and you can feel them like that. And so, yeah, so it's been a really incredible journey, Karina. I mean, really just incredible. I mean, I of course give anything to be able to live my later years and the rest of my life with Richard by my side and in body. But, you know, it once I healed, I'm so blessed, and I'm so blessed with having had such an incredible love, and also for that deep understanding that love transcends the boundaries of time and space and even death. You know, love transcends. And I think that realization is so powerful, and it makes your life, you know, first of all, you know, I can't say that I'm really afraid to die at all anymore, except that I wouldn't want to leave my kids right now. I think my kids are really, that would devastate them. And I hate that thought. But I think once you're not afraid to die, then you really, really begin to live, and you really, really begin to take it all in. And you know how temporary it is here for all of us. And that was a message that Richard told me a lot early on after his passing, was he would say, it's such a short time. It's such a short time. I'll be back for you before you know it.
So beautiful. And you know, like when you are sharing this story, I had a little bit one part similar, let's say, when I lost my father. And I lost my father, it was, you know, like you mentioned, you had your father and your husband, like really kind of the model, and you really love both. And I received a call. And that call completely changed my life. And I was really thinking, how was it for you to even deal with that, even after that, you know, when the phone was ringing and with the fear that some other close loved ones, something can happen to them. How did you deal with that?
I think, like, I just knew I had to. I knew I had to. I think it helped me having children that I had to be strong for. And I, you know, I mean, I, the, I don't know how to answer that, except that I think that there's this time period that, you know, you just survive, you know, you just survive. You're not really worried about anything but survival. And certainly you're not sweating the small stuff, I will say.
Yeah, this time, yes, not.
You're having a perfect perspective about that. So, yeah. I think that what's hard for me now, I mean, I think about that is, I really don't want to go through that again, you know, like that. Like, I don't want to love so deeply that it hurts so bad, like, to lose somebody like that. And I know that that's the one way that is very deeply impacted me and changed me. And it's not that I don't love and I can't love. It's just that I think there's a deep, that's what I work on right now today, is that deep fear that I have of losing somebody that I love. And yet, I mean, I've known other people, they've lost several spouses, and they actually, I mean, this is terrible, but they do say it gets easier. It's terrible to say that. They even say that with hesitation. But I suppose it's because of the understanding of death, and mm-hmm. and that when people die, they're not really gone. You know, I mean, I think yeah. I think that, you know, that changes it a lot and changes how somebody grieves too. Mm-hmm.
I was during my research before our interview, I was really listen a few interviews with you before and after Richard died, and I really have to say I could really see a big difference in a way yeah. of you were, but I really start to see this powerful woman, so like unbeatable as yeah. well. You could see the sad eyes, but oh. then you start this journey of helping others to heal as well.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think really the joy of helping others is, I don't think we can replace that joy with anything. I think that when we find our true calling in this world, and many times, I mean, Richard used to say this, I remember right before he died, actually a couple months before, we were walking up a hill and he said, "Chris, you know what I love about the human spirit?" And I was like, "What, honey?" "What, honey?" And he says, "I love that there's people in this world that take their greatest tragedy and they allow it to move them forward in life, so their life has greater meaning than it might have otherwise had." And that came back to me so instantly after he died. You know, it was like an instruction he was giving me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how that was going to take form, but I think when I found my path to helping women, and especially women who have gone through great loss, it has given me so much joy to inspire and to be that beacon, one of those beacons of hopes. And I have many friends in the you know, the life reentry movement, the grief movement, the healing from grief. I have many friends, and we all feel the same way. We just feel like it's such a privilege and an honor to be that person that can help that other person out of the trenches of grief, because it's a tough path, and it's the hardest thing we do as humans is to grieve, the hardest thing.
And I know that you start to open your heart and to write The Heartbroken Open.
Yep.
And as well, your recent one, From Heartbroken to Wholeness, which is the journey side of it. Yeah. And I will make sure to tag all the books. I know these ones are the favorite for so many of the ones that you were reading. Tell us a little bit about that, those two books.
Well, I wrote Heartbroken Open, a memoir through loss to self-discovery. It was really came from my journal of the first 2 years going through grief. And so it's a very powerful, very rich memoir about loss and about love and about healing. And I'm actually going to be, that book is out of print. I'm going to be re-releasing that book in a couple months, in a few months. So You can still get some hard copies online, but it's a beautiful, beautiful story. And And I then wrote From Heartbreak to Wholeness, The Hero's Journey to Joy, 10 years later, because I knew it wouldn't be my most popular book, but it is my most meaningful book that I could ever write. And I know that for the people who read it and really read it and do the inner work that goes along with it, they will be better people for having read this book and for having dealt with their pain and their sorrow in a way that makes them a much stronger, a much more resilient, and a much better person.
So beautiful. And speaking about the healing journey, now you are supporting many others. And I know that you actually start a program, What Now, for quite a while, and now you are restarting the course.
I am. You know, for a long time, I really had the course as a prerequisite for my retreats. I would have people who came to my What Now retreat, they had to do the first four sections of the course before they came. So they did. And what it would do is it would just, everybody would be on the same page and everybody.
Prepare them.
Yeah. Everybody would be really ready to do a deep dive into where they were in their lives. And most of the time, this is a program designed for people to really find what they want to do next. It's really about being able to dream and to put yourself in the place of being open to all possibility, and then discerning what it is you really want by looking at what you value. Because a lot of times we just live our lives and then we get to this midlife part of life where we're just in midlife and we're going through some kind of crisis. It could be brought on by change, but a lot of times people go through an identity crisis because they realize they've changed, but they don't know who they are. They no longer know who they are. And so I created this program for that woman, you know, for that woman who really wants to live this next part of her life with great passion and great engagement and really figuring out what is her next thing.
And I suppose this is related to everyone that they lost, not necessarily the husband. I mean, I was thinking now to so many of my friends that they would love to join your what you are doing. I mean, they need to, and they lost really loved ones, mothers, some kids. Can they participate to this?
Oh, yeah. It's not about, this isn't for widows. This is for women.
Okay.
This is for women who are going through a change and they really want to rediscover themselves. So it's like the ultimate personal growth program, really. I mean, but personal development in the sense of taking that deep dive into who you are now and who are you after this life you've lived? I mean, a lot of times we just live life and, you know, we don't know why we did it the way we did it, but we get to these places where we're just like, okay, it's all over. That part of my life is over now. Now what? What now? What am I doing now with the rest of my life? And I think if we just live, I mean, we could live haphazardly or just from moment to moment, and that's great too. But I think it's also really great to ask yourself some deep questions and really tap into your own inner deep wisdom. And I find the only way for me to do that is to ask myself a question.
What will be the first question that you advise everyone that they can start this journey to ask themselves?
Yeah, I would ask everyone to start asking, you know, what is it that they really, really deeply desire for their mind? What is it that they deeply desire for their body? What is it that they deeply desire, you know, for their relationships? And for their work, you know, so it to me, it's about tuning into what is your longing and what are you longing for, you know, and what kind of passion do you need to rediscover in order to fulfill that longing? You know, I think our passion really does lead us in a direction. And when we can follow what we are excited about, even if it's moment to moment, that like leaves breadcrumbs for us to like a trail. If you could just ask yourself that one question, what am I excited about? What am I excited about right now? Maybe it's having a cup of coffee. well, maybe on the way to the coffee, you know, something happens, or maybe it's going on a hike, and maybe on that hike you have an insight or an awareness, or some, you see someone or something happens, or, you know, but I think if we can, oftentimes with people who've gone through loss and they feel that sense of malaise and even they feel like they're dying, I say to them, all you have to do is find one thing moment to moment to feel excited about, because that's very contagious. And we're natural enthusiasts. People are just naturally going to gravitate toward what is positive for them. But sometimes you have to find that one small thing in order to start moving in that direction. Then it's like a steamroller.
I can't realize it. We are already 1 hour through, and time with you was going so fast. Thank you so much for that. I have my last question. Somehow you answer on it, but I want to really be much, even from my side, for the ones that they are really in this moment now that they just lost the loved ones. What you would advise them to do in this moment?
Well, I would say, when you're going through immediate loss, when you're just going through it, I would tell you to not busy yourself. I would say to allow yourself lots of spaciousness to be in a cocoon of healing, to create, you know, time with, you know, definitely spend time with your family and close friends. Don't isolate away from other people, but definitely don't be overly busy. You know, try not to go back to work too fast. Try not to, you know, be so busy that you're distracted from grieving, because if you really have grief, you know, you want to allow yourself time to heal and time to grieve.
Thank you so much, Christine, for your time and all these learnings that you share with us today.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much, Krina. It's been wonderful. You're just a wonderful, wonderful host, and you have such a beautiful, beautiful voice to listen to. So thank you.
Wow. Another amazing conversation. Thank you so much, dear Christine, for sharing all your learnings. I really wish you all the best to all your projects. I know you are working to some amazing new projects, and I can't wait to share to my community. Regarding you, my dear friend, thank you so much for listening this episode and for joining this beautiful community. For more inspiring interviews, head it over on Spotify, Google Podcast, iTunes, or wherever you are listening now. I have more surprises coming soon. If you like today's show, please share it with your friends, family, or community. I'm Krina, and you've been listening to the podcast How Can I Heal? With Krina Okumus.